Hello, Will.
Good morning, Rohan. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Very well. And it's not just you we've got today.
No. Today we're talking about PPE. And we've got a friend of mine, Tom, to come and have a chat with us about what that's like. Tom, say hello.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tom. I did PPE Oxford from 2016 to 2019.
It's a good set of years, wasn't it, Tom?
It was a great set of years. Me and Will spent them together. We had some good times.
Yes. So Tom and I were at Christchurch, obviously doing different things, but I think it's fair to say a fair bit of time together. We thought, you know, get Tom in. Obviously, it's a huge topic, huge subject, PPE, really popular. Lots of people want to study it. And so who better to sort of talk about it than someone who's been through it, I'd say, relatively recently, right, Rohan?
Yeah, absolutely. So Tom, just before we kind of kick off in the nitty-gritty, what are you up to now?
So I graduated in 2019, so just before COVID, and then I kind of had a kind of gap year, and then after that I joined the civil service, so I'm on the Treasury graduate scheme now. So I'm 18 months through that and just starting my second placement on Tuesday, actually. So that's fun.
Wow, exciting.
Yeah. And 20 years in number 11?
So that's not the natural career path, I think. maybe a perm sec or something. That could be a good place to be.
So and how important would you say PPE was to sort of that pathway?
I actually think fairly important. So there's actually fairly few science graduates in that kind of line of work. Like within my cohort at Treasury, I think like 80 people joined at the same time. I would say like at least 3/4, if not 4/5, were humanities graduates. Mm. Quite a few of us did PPE or PPE equivalents at other universities. I think the main thing it gives you is kind of you spend your degree writing essays where you kind of weigh up different arguments, different pieces of evidence, and then try and form a judgment. And that's kind of what you're doing in the job in a lot of ways. So I think like that's kind of the natural way you can see PPE translating into a civil service job. And then I suppose the other thing worth noting is that PPE as a course, which I think was designed for Oxford, was originally designed for people going into the civil service. That was kind of its purpose in the first place. That was about 80 years ago, and things moved on since then, but I think something retains from that.
And did you know that the Treasury and the civil service might be something that you're interested in, and sort of before you chose PPE?
No, not really. I largely picked PPE just because I was interested in it. So my mum was kind of from a literature background. My dad was from a science background. But I always grew up doing really well at sciences at schools. And then I think at some point in maybe like late year 11, early lower 6, something just clicked in me. And I was like, I just don't find science like that interesting for me. Mm. Like I'm okay at it. But it just doesn't really like, I had no interest in reading around it or anything like that. Meanwhile, like there was a bunch of political stuff going on at the time. So you had like the Scottish referendum in 2014 and the election in 2015, which were both things that happened, I think, when I was, it was in year 11, then I was in lower sixth. And I think that just kind of really interested me in the politics side of things. And then at that point, I kind of had a look around for what kind of courses were available. And that kind of led me to do wider reading on stuff like philosophy and economics.
Okay. This is actually a really nice segue into the application process, right? Well done. As if scripted.
Mm.
Okay. So for someone thinking about going to the Treasury or something like that, it's something to have in mind. But if you're not sure what you want to do anyway, if it's something that you're interested in, a good subject. So I guess talk a little more about that application process. When did you think you'd apply to Oxford? Like, had that been something on your mind for a while?
So I think it had been on my mind for quite a long time, but I hadn't really ever kind of thought about it in a serious way. I just kind of thought, oh, I'd like to go to Oxford or a good university kind of thing, but not like seriously put any thought into kind of how the application process works. I think my school took me on like a open day thing. I think this was near the end of or near the middle of lower sixth, where we kind of went to like a outreach event where there were like five lectures. Well, you could attend a bunch of lectures, but you attended about five on subjects you chose to do. And that gave me a kind of idea of it. And that kind of firmed up in my mind that I wanted to do PPE. The actual like process of application, I think we were all sat down and had a bit of a talk towards the end of lower six saying, here's what's coming up for you. Here's when you need to do your personal statements by, that sort of thing. So I think the process like really started to kick off over the summer when I started to like read books and stuff so that I can include them in my personal statement. And then I guess the first term of upper six was quite heavily dominated, I guess, by the whole application process.
Yeah. Yeah. And because obviously we would have been sitting the same TSA, for me, I quite enjoyed it as a test. It was it was a lot more fun than some of the exams that we were doing at the time. But like, how was it sort of seen by you and your friends who were applying as well?
Yeah. So I agree with you on the TSA, actually. Interesting test. Makes you think a lot more, especially at that point. I guess you've done some lower sixth exams, but largely your exam experience is essentially like rote learning where you just repeat facts. And this is like radically, radically different to that. So the actual TSA itself, I quite enjoyed that. I mean, difficult, and you had to practice a lot to kind of really get into it. Although I guess it's defined as a test that in theory you can't revise much for. And I suppose that's true to a certain extent in that you
well, there's no content, right? Or there's limited content.
Yeah, exactly. But still, you had to practice a lot for it. The essay section, I think that one I found harder because the TSA, you could at least kind of do practice questions and find out if you got them right or not. The essay question, you were going into fairly blind. Like, I remember the only sort of like serious understanding I had of how that would go was I spoke to a history teacher about it and was like, how do you think this would be marked? And she was like, I'll have a look, but I'm not really sure. So that side of it was more challenging. But yeah, I really enjoyed the test. I remember the actual TSA itself, the multiple choice bit was fine. And then I went into the TSA essay questions. And I think I did an essay question on abortion. I don't know if you had the same, Will. And I remember you had like this whole idea where you spend like 5 minutes planning or whatever, and then you spend 20 minutes writing. And I spent like 5 minutes 5 minutes planning, and then I spent about 7 or 8 minutes writing. And then I was just like, this is crap. Like, this is the worst thing I've ever read. And I was just like, oh, I really, like, really can't continue with this. So I stopped, and then I started again. And then after that, it was okay. But it was a bit of a rush.
Wow. Yeah. I bet that was really pressed for time.
Yeah. A little bit more stressful than I intended. Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting because of, but like the BMAT, you only have to write one page, and then that's the maximum. The TSA, you can go over to two sides.
Yeah, though I think they are strict on the two-side thing. I think that's right. They don't. I can't quite remember, but I don't think
to write two sides in 30 minutes is much harder than writing one side in 30 minutes. So yeah, you must have really struggled.
Yeah, it was a challenge. But I guess I think it was an unorthodox approach. I don't think I'd recommend doing it unless you really were certain that what you were writing was like fatal to your chances. But I guess it worked out in my instance. I think I also did have enough time, but I do remember my hand like physically hurting as I was writing because I was going at that kind of pace towards the end to get this kind of slightly shortened time frame essay done.
Yeah. Wow. I don't remember what I actually did for the real essay, but I remember doing a practice essay about legalization of drugs. So it was those kind of things, those sort of broad questions where you could really, whilst you only had two pages, I'm sure there has been lots and lots written and discussed about these kind of topics. So sort of condensing that down into something is pretty tricky, right?
Yeah, I think so. And also, I guess their idea there is they want as much as possible for people to use their own ideas in at least some form, and therefore you can't just kind of recite various different ideas from various people. Like, you are limited to maybe like one or two arguments per side, I think, at most on those papers.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So you sort of had a bit of a strange experience with the TSA, but feeling relatively good. I guess now it's probably because obviously you apply to Oxford and a few other places that do PPE, but there's no PPE at Cambridge. So maybe more for Rohan, like what do students do? What's their alternative over there, Rohan?
Oh, sorry, I didn't know that you're talking to.
I am. So my understanding is that they've got HSPS, which is like something. I can't remember what it stands for, but it's a bit of a limited choice. And then on the econ side, they were extremely strict. I remember not extremely, extremely strict, but the person I spoke to about it was like, if you haven't done further maths, you're probably not going to get in, kind of thing, which PPE doesn't have as a requirement, which I guess makes the econ side a bit friendlier.
Yeah. And the economics at Cambridge is, you know, fiercely mathematical. So we've helped some students get in without further maths, but yeah, it is just one of those. If you don't have it, then you are up against it. Yeah, HSPS is an interesting one, Tom, because it sounds like human, social, political sciences, but I don't know if they actually do much, because I suppose that there's quite a fine line between history and politics, right? And I assume it's just some, whether it happened 40 years ago or if it happened earlier than 50 years and it turns into history, I assume it's that kind of demarcation. I don't know if the Cambridge economics course does any history. I think it's all politics, but the HSPS does politics as well. So it seems to be like, oh, they've almost split the PPE course into two. Or I suppose PPE is like a combination of those two at Oxford.
Yeah, I suppose so. I guess you could kind of split it if you kind of thought of econ as more sciencey, if you kind of take that line. And I think a lot of economists do see it in a very mathematical sense. And to be fair, economics at Oxford, the first year was fairly mathsy. Like you didn't need further maths for it. They were quite reasonable about that. And then you didn't actually even need maths for it. They would do like a catch-up course. If you got in without A-level maths, your first few weeks would be spent just doing some quite heavy, like just learning to do differentiation and stuff, which actually I think is part of the GCSE syllabus now, but wasn't at the time, just so that you can deal with graphs. And that sort of thing. But yeah, the later economics in Oxford, you could kind of split out and do more qualitative stuff, as I understand it, but still a fairly maths-based thing. I'm not really sure. I imagine human, social, political sciences involves like some more kind of general like sociology stuff about like society and anthropology and stuff like that. I imagine you could get that in PPE, but you'd probably have to pick some fairly niche modules later on.
And so where else... Because obviously people listening to this might be thinking of applying for PPE. Where else could you apply as well to do PPE? Because I know not all universities offer it.
So it's increasingly being offered as a course. So I remember the year I applied was the first year that LSE was doing PPE, for example. So I think most universities that have like a humanities side to them, a lot of them are now offering PPE. So where I applied were, my second choice was York. That was a slight risk in the sense that you had the same grades to get into York as Oxford. But the kind of understanding was that with York, they were generally willing to flex the grades like on the day of results. Well, Oxford would obviously never flex the grades on the day of results. And then I also applied for LSE, UCL, I think, and Manchester, but a bunch of places do it, like Durham, St Andrews, Southampton, Birmingham, King's. There's a pretty wide range of Warwick, pretty wide range of places doing it. I remember York had particularly high ratings for politics and philosophy, and I quite liked the city, which is kind of why I chose it.
Yeah, it's a really nice city. And Tom, how much support did you get from various people in the whole application process?
So my school was fairly good at kind of helping people with the process. I think that had been more of a recent thing. So they had a member of staff who was a history teacher at Standard, but she also had been to Cambridge and understood the process. And she kind of supported people with that side of the application. So having like a specific point of contact who knew what was going on was fairly important. In terms of the TSA, in terms of personal statement, we were given as much support as anyone else in the year. But then I suppose the personal statement is important, but not the most important bit. The TSA, we were fairly left to our own devices, but I think that's fair enough. Like it's not like anyone in the school really knew how the TSA worked that well anyway. For interviews, we had some paid sessions with an interview coach, not really a coach, but someone who like did interview practices for Oxford. For what it's worth, none of them were anything like what my interviews were like, but it was, I guess, still useful. And then we had some interviews with like former members of staff and that sort of thing who just came in to give us like a kind of fresh face. Because I guess that's the thing for interviews is you just kind of need to talk to people about stuff to some extent. It's not like a rigid process all the time.
Yeah. It sounds like you had like a fair amount of support, actually. Like some students go through the whole process of having not even had an interview or any practice at all with the interview prep.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was a decent school for that. I think when we had a few people applying for Oxford in our year, and they did take it seriously, which was good, and it was a good amount of support to have, really. Because I think like you can self-motivate to do it, but for example, interviews, it seems quite weird to just like try and convince people to have a practice interview kind of thing. So it was good that the school offered to do that in the first place.
Yeah. What was your actual interview like? You said it wasn't like the practice ones, but how did it go?
No. So I really enjoyed interviews like as a process. Like it was just kind of I applied for Christchurch directly. They put on quite like a nice few days. So I think you were there for 2 or 3 nights, maybe. You got there on the Sunday, you had an intro chat with the professors about how the interviews would work. There were about 30 people applying for PPE at Christchurch. And I think they were kind of saying there would be 10 places available. So fairly competitive, but also lots of people who were going through the same thing as you, which made the environment quite nice. So you got to chat to people. So I had a good time overall. The interviews themselves, I had 4 interviews. They were 30-minute interviews split in half. And midway through each interview, there would be one person interviewing and one person taking some notes. Midway through, they would switch roles. So the first one I had was philosophy and economics, but entirely distinct philosophy and economics sections. The philosophy, from what I remember, was something to do with the morality of rats. It was very
rats,
yeah, whether they had morality, and they'd done some science experiments to show that rats had like a level of morality. I'm not sure how well I did. I mean, you never really know how well you did in each one. I just remember I didn't really get the idea that rats could have much morality, and I think I just kept disputing the central argument, which maybe wasn't the best idea ever, but potentially worked, potentially didn't. The economics one was quite nice. It was just a discussion about outsourcing. That was fairly accessible to me, who didn't know anything about economics really. Like that was my philosophy and politics I knew a bit about, but economics I was very, very like, I'd never studied it. I didn't know that much about it. So doing a general discussion about how outsourcing worked was good. I've definitely heard of people having harder things and having to do it maths and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
The second interview was politics. The first half, we were shown this graph, and the graph had like a few lines on it, and each line represented a country. But then the lines were made up of various different metrics kind of amalgamated into kind of showing this power index of how powerful a country was over time.
Sure.
And you had to kind of interpret the graph, and then you had to kind of talk about what maybe the graph was missing. And I think everyone seemed to end up with the same discussion, where we suggested that the idea of soft power was missing. These graphs kind of had economic size, military size, etc., but they weren't really indicating any sort of like diplomatic presence. And then the tutor would be like, "Oh, what does soft power mean?" And then rejected every single definition you came up with.
Okay.
And then the second one was quite fun. It was kind of something I kind of knew a lot about, which I think helped. Where you were shown this electoral system, which was very proportional, and then the government of the day in this made-up country decided to change the electoral system to make it less proportional. And we just had discussions about like both the practical effects of that and like whether it was like kind of correct from like a moral, democratic, etc. perspective. I quite enjoyed that one. I think that was something I kind of thought about a lot. I think helpful, I guess, that I'd been a bit of a politics nerd and had followed the like referendum on voting reform a few years back quite heavily. So yeah, that was my experience of the four interviews, and I broadly enjoyed it. They were challenging, but I came out of all of them thinking I haven't embarrassed myself, which is a good start. Yeah.
So I've got a couple of questions. Oh, sorry, Rohan, you go ahead.
I was just saying that just on those four interviews, I mean, they're such broad topics, aren't they? To expect someone to be able to kind of hold an intelligent discussion, I mean, that in itself is quite an achievement. You know, it's much more impressive than, say, just talking about maths for 2 hours, for example. Yeah. So how did you go about preparing for these, Tom? Like, because you said you didn't have any economics background. Were you expecting to get grilled on economics quite hard?
So they always said you don't need economics, you don't need philosophy, you don't need politics to apply to PP at Oxford.
As an A-level, do you mean?
As an A-level, yeah. I think there was even a slightly untrue assumption that they actually didn't like those subjects. I think that probably wasn't true, but they definitely did try to make it clear that if you did those subjects, it wouldn't benefit you, or it shouldn't benefit you at least, and you certainly shouldn't be like hurt by not doing those subjects. In terms of preparation, I think the best way to do it was I just did a bit of reading, really, and spoke to people where possible. I think it's, as they are meant to be accessible conversations, in theory, they're the kind of things you could have with like your parents or your friends. So having like conversations about politics with your friends or your parents is always quite easy, slightly harder on philosophy and economics, obviously. Tried to read around, like classic, I bought a few issues of The Economist and tried to read them to get me thinking about it. I borrowed an A-level economics textbook from the business teacher, kind of scrolled through that. I don't think any of those things were like particularly effective, though, to be honest. I think it was more just like general preparation in doing like chatting to people and having practice interviews and reading that got you thinking more about like arguments and how to argue and how to make a point. That was more useful, way more useful than any sort of like subject specific knowledge. Like all my outsourcing knowledge came from me just having a vague idea of what outsourcing was and like political debates about whether we should like move jobs abroad or not that we'd seen come up in say like geography or something.
Yeah, I guess because the idea of the interview isn't like, it's not like a test. It's not to see sort of how much economics do you know, how much philosophy do you know, or how much, you know, maths, physics do you know per se. But I think it's slightly more reassuring if whatever they start talking about, you've at least heard of before or talked about before in some kind of way. Like maybe you don't have to have read loads of textbooks on it, but you're familiar with it to a degree. But of course, that can go the other way, because whilst it's good to be familiar about it, you don't want to have like an entrenched opinion about it, which just means that you can't then discuss it. So I think the way that you want to engage with these topics is through discussions and not through sort of being too dogmatic on the day. Because if they sort of suggest something and you just say, it's this, and then they sort of suggest other stuff, they say, no, it's this.
Yeah, like the morality of squirrels.
Yeah, Tom got away with it somehow.
Yeah. They maybe secretly agreed with me. I don't know. Yeah, the thing I always heard, which I thought was potentially quite astute. I mean, you never know if it's true, right? But like the idea that in an interview, the tutor is looking for someone, in theory, they'll have to have tutorials with for like 1 hour a week for the next 3 years. Yeah. So if you have an interesting discussion, that's where you like kind of, even if you don't know something and you're able to come up with something fairly kind of interesting and insightful, that's probably a big bonus for yourself compared to someone who can just list out facts. Yeah. And bore a tutor who already knows those facts, kind of thing. That's the thing that's actually going to endear you to someone who wants to kind of talk with you, I guess, over the next couple of years.
Yeah. So that graph that you got given at the start of your politics one, Tom, were you given time to read that in advance?
No. So I know of some people who did interviews who did have time to read stuff in advance and were given a half hour. We weren't really, we were shown it. We were allowed to look at it for maybe like a minute or so. You probably could have asked if you were really struggling for a bit more time. But I think the idea was have a look at the graph and then very quickly move on to being given questions on it.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that as well is quite a challenge, right? Or presumably something that you're not very used to at school. Because rarely are you given that kind of stuff, and then immediately you have to start interpreting, and not only interpreting it like in a written way in an exam, but actually explaining that to someone else. I don't really think I had that too much at school. In my interviews, we were given sort of 20 minutes to look at, if there was stuff to look at, we had time to look at that before and then come into it. So again, another challenge.
Yeah, I think so. I think that was kind of true for all the interviews.
Yeah.
Even in the ones where you didn't have a physical thing to look at, you were still basically thrown. They were like, we'll be talking about outsourcing. And then immediately a question about outsourcing. You didn't really have much time to think through before you jumped straight into it, which I think is good to an extent, and something you can kind of practice a bit, like someone giving you quick fire questions. I think the important thing is not to try and panic under those circumstances. Yeah.
So that's quite a lot about the application process, but we haven't really talked about what PPU was like while you were studying it. Why don't you sort of do an overview of your 3 years, sort of separate them out? I know the sort of the specific things you study changes, and they'll be quite good for people to hear.
Yeah, so I started in October 2016. So first year PPE, everyone does the same thing. Mm. So everyone does a module called Ethics, which focuses on one specific text, which is Utilitarianism by Mill. I don't know why I struggled with who it was by there, because I lived it for a term. The other things you do in philosophy in first year are a bit of like knowledge and reality, does this exist, kind of very fairy stuff, and a bit of like formal logic, which is kind of maths, version of maths. I always thought of it as version of maths, but for philosophy. Politics, you'd a bit of a theory and a bit of practical, I think it's called practical, oh, comparative politics, where it kind of looks at like how systems of government work and that sort of thing.
Explain what sort of politics theory would look like.
Yeah, so politics theory was you would look at people who kind of wrote about how politics should be. So like Marx, who obviously liked communism, or you might have someone who advocated more for like freedom of speech, liberal values. You might take this down to more specific topics, like, I don't know, is violence possible? In the political arena, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So these kind of big thinkers that you'll have heard of and you'll encounter a little bit, maybe while you're like reading around the subject, drilling in detail, you look at like the primary text of what they've written and what people have written about what they've written.
Oh, no countdown.
No countdown.
Cool. We can cut that out.
Great. So for economics, it was quite heavily maths-based. We did microeconomics, which is, And I really wasn't very good at economics, so I'm probably not the best person to talk about the first year economics course. But microeconomics, which is looking at like individual, like the more individual decisions, supply and demand curves, that sort of thing. Macroeconomics, which is looking at the kind of wider economy and how that can be affected by different factors in it. And then a little bit of kind of essay writing, qualitative questions about what kind of goes on in economics. So that was first year, and then you set end of first year exams, which are fairly straightforward. Like you have to work quite hard to revise for them, but they're nothing to really worry about, I don't think. In second and third year, you're given a lot more choice, so you can either keep all three subjects or drop down to just two.
And my understanding at the time was that dropping down to just two is the norm. Is that right?
Yeah. So I'd say about 70 to 80% of people drop down to two. It doesn't affect what's written on the degree certificate. So you're still called PP at the end of it. So a lot of people would drop one. I chose to drop economics because I much preferred politics and philosophy and found the economics quite difficult.
Yeah.
There are some mandatory modules in each subject. I can't remember exactly what they were. Sometimes they're from a choice. So, for example, politics, you had to do two of five modules, and then two or more out of another like 25. And the two of the five kind of small choice were more kind of bigger things like theory, comparative, sociology, history. And then the two out of the bigger choice would have been any range of stuff. So like drilling down on, I did one on Marx and Marxism, which like specifically looked at, well, Marx and communism and that sort of thing, or more like specific aspects of comparative politics, researchier things. You could do a thesis, that sort of thing. Philosophy similar, except you had to do a module on ethics if you did philosophy. But after you'd done ethics, you were given a pretty broad range of choice in what you wanted to do. Again, about 25, 30 modules you could choose from. And for economics, there were less module choice and there were more things you had to do. I think they've liberalized it a little bit more now. Yeah. But you still had to do kind of micro macro and something, I think, which was called like quantitative methods or something. And then after that, there were about six or seven. You could choose a couple of those to do.
Okay.
So basically, the story is there are some core modules, but about half your modules, about three quarters of your modules, you're given at least a fair amount of choice on.
Yeah.
And within those, about half of them, more than half, you're given a really, really large amount of choice on. So you can kind of take the course in any direction you want to. And I found doing the kind of niche modules, I often enjoyed those a little bit more because you ended up with kind of a small cohort of people doing it. The tutors were always like super into the topic. You were like really given to people who really cared about the topic and were really into it. So those modules I often found better than, say, modules that were done by like a really large proportion of the year, basically. But you could take it in any direction you wanted to, really.
But that's up to 25 modules.
Yeah, so I think it was about that. So economics was a lot smaller. Economics was only about 12 choices, I think. And then you did eight modules across the next 2 years, essentially across the next four or five terms before you started revising. And you got to kind of fill in those with first the mandatory modules, and then later ones you kind of chose to do yourself. Well, what I felt was good. It's not fair.
And how did the exams work?
I found it more relaxing to kind of not have to worry about exams my whole time there. So you only have you have your exams at the end of first year and then you have the exams at the end of third year. So you spend 2 years studying and then you have all your exams in like a kind of two or 3 week period at the end. And I think they're going back to normal with exams now. I'm not really sure. But you get dressed up in this kind of suit thing called Subfusc, and then you go down to a place called exam schools and then you all sit and you write your essays with pen and paper. And each exam is 3 hours long and you write three essays, I think was like fairly standard, as how the exam worked. And yeah, it was like everyone was in it together. It was all right. It could be hot, I think was the main takeaway. They didn't really, and it was hot and they didn't really have clocks that really worked very well. It wasn't like in secondary school where they put a big projector up with like a digital clock so you could see exactly what the time was. They'd have like three clocks on the wall and they'd all be analog and they'd all show slightly different times and it would stretch you out a little bit. But yeah, they were all right. They were good fun. And then at the end of it, there's this big thing called trashing where you go outside and all your friends throw kind of paint at you and that sort of thing, which is always good fun.
I mean, but it was kind of outlawed at the time, wasn't it? Like, it was never approved.
It's now been outlawed.
No, they did occasionally send around statements saying, don't do this. We won't allow you to do this.
Yeah.
But never with any sort of force behind it, because it wasn't really something they could control. Yeah, like if people didn't do it right outside exam schools, they'd just go somewhere else to do it.
Somewhere else, yeah.
And it's pretty hard to enforce. I mean, I don't know why, if you were a car, you'd want to drive through that street at the time.
In case you don't like your tyres.
Yeah. That's a shame. It's a shame if they've actually gotten rid of it. It was always quite good fun. I know there were environmental concerns, but I felt they were kind of dealing with those with the more biodegradable materials.
Trashing, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd always thought trashing was like this age-old tradition. And I was kind of like, how could you stop this age-old tradition, quintessentially Oxford? Then I found out it's only like 30 years old or something. It was like in the 60s or the 70s, maybe. They just started doing it. Which kind of dispelled that for me. But I was still pretty, it's quite enjoyable. other people at other universities, you just sort of walk out of your exams and there's no like, it feels a bit anticlimactic, I think, as if you walk out and then you go through the trashing process, then it is quite exciting.
Yeah. Cambridge has that too. I think Oxford does it a little bit more severely though. I mean, we just pop over some champagne typically, whereas I've heard it's a lot more extreme.
Some people, I mean, for a lot of people, it's just... a fizzy drink, champagne, Lambrini, whatever, shaving foam and confetti, that kind of thing. Then maybe some like smoke stuff, some paint stuff, and then maybe some sort of food stuff as well. But you can just sort of do what you want with it, really.
Food was definitely less popular, I think, by the time we got there. There was quite
as food was becoming less and less popular as well. Yeah,
quite a strong message against using food, which I think people did listen to. Yeah. I do remember I got egged at one point during mine, which sounds like it looks hilarious, but really you just got hit by eggs. It was actually quite sore, so I'm quite a fan of that not being a thing.
Mm. But interesting, so Tom... Oh, sorry.
Yeah, well, my friend...
There's so much stuff in my eyes. Shower foam right in your face eyes as well. Is something that's meant to really you can't really see for... Well, you finish your exam, you go outside, then you can't really see for the next 10 or 15 minutes till someone manages to give you some sort of liquid to wash your eyes out with.
Yeah. Or you're in the river, right?
In the river. Lost my glasses in the river in first year. That was really fun. Yeah, and then all I had were like prescription sunglasses. So I had to spend like the next 3 days of celebrating exams looking completely ridiculous, wearing sunglasses and like, clubs and stuff.
Oh, well.
And Tom, just on that, I mean, I could see Will smiling when you were talking about exams. Do most people take it reasonably carefully that they'll prepare at the end of second year, or is it kind of because it's the idea of not having exams at the end of a Oxford year seemed quite alien to me. Do most people kind of give themselves mocks, or how do you motivate yourself to study at the end of second year?
Was I never quite did as much as I wanted to. I don't think I've ever done quite as much as I wanted to.
Does
anyone, exactly. So I guess you have to be realistic about it. So so you have 8 modules. I did them in the first 4 terms, which meant in theory, I'd finished all my learning by December 2018, which meant I had 2 terms left to do all my revision in. But the first term, I was fairly slow about it. I just kind of like went over essays. I kind of summarized them a bit, but I didn't do this at any sort of pace, I would say. And then I kind of picked it up towards the end, and then over the Easter break, and then into the term following. In terms of mocks, I always knew I should have done more. You know, you always think you should have done more, but it is difficult to motivate yourself to do those kind of long essays. So the kind of compromise I reached was I did essay plans, which are not perfect compromises, but they're quite a good way of just setting out what you would have written in an essay. They don't teach you exactly what you're going to write or like how to kind of write good sentences and make good arguments under time pressure, but they're a decent compromise. I did quite a lot of those. I did a lot of just like making...
I did
other bits and bobs, and like occasionally I'd have like catch-up tutorials where like, and that was quite common, where you'd like miss something over the course of the 8-week term, but generally I just had that time for kind of slow gradual revision.
Wow. And if so, to the young aspiring PPE student listening to this, Tom, any advice, any tips, any things for them to think about?
So I think the interview is the most important. Like, if you're convinced you want to do PPE, do a good personal statement, do a good TSA and revise for it a lot. But I think the big thing is like the interviews and like being able to make half decent arguments and have interesting discussions with people. And I think the fairly straightforward way to prepare yourself for that is to be engaged over a fairly decent period of time with politics, philosophy, and economics. So like read the news, read magazines, read articles that you find interesting, read books, and then discuss them with people.
Obviously, some are easier to discuss than others. I don't know, when I was at sixth form, a lot of the time we just discussed football and that sort of thing. So not something that was actually useful.
Yeah, that didn't come up in the interview, did it?
Yeah, weirdly.
Oxford seemed to have this predilection for using animals as weird concepts. My best friend had a was asked to like do squirrels things, have which presence I guess of mind.
Tells you so, that you can't really prepare.
They seem to enjoy these weird concepts.
If squirrels have sentience of mind, then you've prepared for pretty much every single topic ever in your brain.
Eventuality,
But yeah, just have chats with people, have arguments, and that will make you better at the things you need to be good at to kind of get through the interview process. And I guess be passionate about the stuff as well. They like that as well. I think that's not to be underrated. Don't do a subject just because you feel you should do a subject.
Yeah.
Do it kind of for good reasons.
Did you ever find out if rats do have morality?
So I did eventually bring this up with my tutor, like, 2.5 years later, and I was like, I remember this. And yeah, so I had the same, particularly that philosophy tutor, I had him consistently over the next couple of years, and I did eventually bring it up with him, and it sounded like we were just on completely different wavelengths. I'm not sure he even thought it was about whether rats had morality. He seemed to think it was a different question altogether that was being posed. So maybe I was saying something interesting. But who knows, really? I'm sure he doesn't have an answer either, for what it's worth.
Yeah. Well, all the good questions don't have answers, right? Really interesting, Tom. I think it's, you know, PPE is a topic, it's a subject that is talked about so often, but that's, you know, it's so helpful to get a good sense from sort of start to finish what it looks like, and obviously, you know, what it can then go into as well. Now, listeners will know that every week Rohan and I have brought a fact to the table, and I believe you've brought a fact to the table as well, Tom. But we don't normally specify an order. Does anyone want to go first?
God, I'll go. So I was watching, my fact is inspired from the film Interstellar. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but there's a really cool scene in there where they're descending onto a planet and their ship hits a cloud. Except the cloud isn't just air, it's actually a solid cloud. And this was like basically science fiction, but very much fiction. Until recently, I think it was only about 18 months ago, they discovered a planet, I think it's called, I mean, it's not a particularly catchy name, it's called K2-141b. But the cool thing about this planet is, well, it's not very cool. It's very, very hot. It's... unlike the Earth and other planets, it doesn't spin on its axis. So it's actually landlocked with the sun. So the same side faces its sun all the time, which means that the temperatures rise quite quickly to about 2,500 degrees Celsius. But the other side is really cool. This is, I mean, relatively cool. It's only 200 degrees. So what happens is, on one side, it's hot enough that literal rocks are melting and evaporating and going into become clouds. And then because there's quite a lot of winds in the planet, those clouds are then going to the other side.
Presumably this is a very far away planet.
And then it's literally raining rocks.
Yeah, so not a holiday destination just yet, but soon.
It's a very far away planet, yeah. Several hundred light years.
Oh, yeah. good point.
Not what you probably want to go to either.
I will go next. Tom finish off with the finale. My fact is, so we're recording this on Easter Sunday, so I wanted to do a related fact. And mine is that in large parts of Germany, it's illegal to dance on Good Friday. It changes a bit from state to state. Some states you're allowed to play music but not dance. Some states the dancing is illegal between particular hours. But yeah, so they take it pretty seriously. It's sort of out of respect. And I thought, well, you know, is this actually enforced? And I couldn't find any evidence of anyone having been arrested for dancing. But there's obviously, there's that potential that you could get arrested for dancing in Germany if you're not careful with your hours. But I actually think like some of the... Well, Tom will know more than either of us.
Religious compared to like states, for example.
But some of the parties in Germany are kind of quite sort of Christian parties. There's a lot of What, sorry? Oh, yeah, political parties. Yeah, absolutely.
Political
parties,
assuming, rather than, like, happy there birthday.
Is debate, like, so all I could find when I was looking for has anyone been arrested by this is, like, debates in the last few years as to whether or not they should get rid of these laws. But there's still obviously a strong enough sentiment to keep them. I mean, Tom, German politics?
So Germany is a fairly religious country. It's kind of like the birthplace of, like, Protestantism, I think.
Sure, yeah.
And it's kept a fairly religious bent. Their main centre-right party is, like, called the Christian Democratic Union or something like that. They only legalised gay marriage, like, a year or two ago. It's a fairly religious country. On the point of laws, I think it's an interesting one, because, I mean, if you look at, like, the UK Parliament, I think there's some, like, weird law that you have to practice archery, like, once every 2 weeks or something if you're a man, which comes from, like, some law 700 years ago that...
Which I do.
We need to be prepared for the French invading, which remains a concern, obviously. But I don't think anyone practices archery, and I don't think anyone gets in trouble for it. And I think there is an interesting point that parliaments are essentially so limited on time. Like, there are so many bills and things that go through them, and a lot of them are actually, like, pertinent issues of the current time, that a lot of the time they just don't bother to repeal stuff. They just kind of stop enforcing it heavily, because that's a far better way to deal with kind of weird old laws than going through the whole process of spending time and money getting rid of the bill. So that might be why they haven't got rid of the dancing bill.
Sure.
I wonder if that means that, you know, what, wonder what would happen if you took someone to court.
I don't know. Maybe.
Not practicing archery once every 2 weeks. Would the court even hear that?
It's a weird one. I don't really get how laws prosecuted on. Because, like, to take a more, like, serious matter, like, if you take, like, UK policy to, like, the police kind of allow, like, certain crimes to get by, for example, like, they're fairly relaxed on kind of certain elements of, like, drug policy these days. They don't actually prosecute people for it, but it remains an actual law, which I find confusing. And maybe it's just that the police have a fairly wide remit and the Crown Prosecution Service have a fairly wide remit on what they can choose to prosecute on, maybe. But I don't really know the details, actually.
Yeah, there we go. We'll work this out once and for all.
Maybe when we get a law student,
I might be completely wrong.
Law chooser, can help.
Yeah. So I can do a fact, but it's also got a question in it because it's a short fact.
Yes, that's very sensible.
Neither of you will know this. There's only one London Underground station which has the word station in its name. Do you know what that is? Because just for context, none of them are called stations. They're all like Waterloo. They're not Waterloo Station.
Is it Battersea Power Station?
The recently opened Battersea Power Station is the only station with station in its name.
Hey, that's good. I only know that because my sort of sister lives in that area. So the new station's up. But I hadn't thought of that before. No, never. Okay, fantastic. Well, Tom, thank you so much for coming in and chatting with us. Like I said, it's been really great to have you on, and it's been, I've certainly learned a little bit more, even though I asked you at the time about PP, I've certainly learned a bit more about what it's like. Rohan, as always, very good to see you. Have a fantastic Easter, everyone. And, you know, listeners, whenever you hear this, potentially in 5 months' time, I hope you had a good Easter as well.
Yeah. And next week, we've got another guest, actually, one of our leading Cambridge psychologists of County York, Oxford Psychology, Will. So he's going to be talking a little bit about what we should be doing.
Thanks for
the
last
term of the year.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Starts to close out. No worries, guys. And just for the listeners, now we have got functioning email now.
Oh, definitely.
So if you do have any questions, queries,
and
comments,
particularly if there's anything you guys want to hear us talk about, you know, any topics that we could do a whole episode, we're very keen to hear what you guys have to say, basically. Take care, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks very much, Tom. Cheers, Will.